The easiest way to get from Heathrow Airport to downtown London is simply to take the train, the subway, the tube. As you make your way from the airport over toward that particular area, you begin to hear this ubiquitous pre-recorded message: the train to Charing Cross is on track 5, going to Trafalgar Square, track 7. You get to the platform where you're actually going to step on to the train, and you begin to hear this: mind the gap. Now, I can't do that in a British accent, but mind the gap. It's really just the kind of information that you expect when you go to a train station. There are two things being done. You are being given information: go to that train if you want to go to that place. And you're given a warning: there's a gap, there's a space between the platform and the train car. Pay attention. Don't want you to fall through the gap. Reminds me a lot of what we're hearing in the book of Hebrews, doesn't it, you? A lot of information. Hebrews chapter 1, Jesus is God, and here's all the things that that means. Chapter 2, pay attention. It's a warning. We're going to see that all the way through. In fact, chapters 3, 4, up through about the middle of chapter 4 is more information about this Jesus, this superior one. And then post-Easter, we're going to come back and we're going to dive into the middle of chapter 4 and we're going to hear, warning, pay attention. That's Hebrews. Teach us, warn us. Let me remind you why that's so significant. These people are Jewish in heritage. They've made an enormous transition from the way they've always lived their life, their religion, their traditions, and they have adopted this Jesus as the Messiah, which was a huge, enormous step out of their comfort zone into a whole new experience, and it hasn't always been easy. And it appears from everything that we can discover that they're tired. They're tired of the pressure from their families to come back to Judaism. They're tired of the pressure of living in a world where their past, Judaism, was acceptable and actually protected by Roman law, to now their renegade kind of, you all are in trouble because you're following this other God, this Jesus. And they're tired. They're tired of the pressure of trying to live faithfully in a world that is doing everything it can to keep them from doing that. In fact, I think Tom Long captured it well when he said, they're tired of serving the world, tired of worship, tired of Christian education, tired of being peculiar, whispered about in society, tired of the spiritual struggle, tired of trying to keep their prayer life going, tired even of Jesus. Been there. Tired. Just tired of the struggle. And some of you know that struggle. You made a decision to follow Jesus. You stepped out of something in order to say yes to Jesus. And the response has not always been as positive as you would have liked. And you're tired of fighting the battle. You're tired of dealing with your family. You're tired of dealing with your boss. You're tired of dealing with the people on the team who want to make fun of you for following Jesus because you don't want to do the things that they want you to do. It's tiring. It's just genuinely tiring. And life circumstances wear us down. I'm convinced, both from reading Hebrews and from talking to Tyler, that that's what led him to the question that we're trying to answer on a weekly basis. Is it worth it? Is all of this life, trying to live in the tension of following Jesus in a world that doesn't really care whether you do or don't, but would prefer you don't, is it worth it? And the text and the sermon from last week answered that question brilliantly. Yes. Why? Because he gets us and he's got us. He became flesh and he knows everything about us. He has lived our life. He's not just empathetic. It goes beyond even empathy to know that he knows exactly who we are, what we are, has experienced what we experienced, and on the other side of that has been the Redeemer who has saved us and is in the process of sanctifying us. He not only gets us, but he has us. Yes, it's worth it. And so Hebrews, in the text that we'll look at in a few minutes, and then again later in chapter 12, is going to say, consider Jesus. Chapter 12 will say it this way, fix your eyes on Jesus. You want to know how to survive being tired? Take a look at Jesus. That's pretty simple, don't you think? And yet Hebrews will say again and again, Jesus is superior. Look at Jesus. Now, what this book is going to say he is superior to is a bit of a struggle for us because, well, quite frankly, Moses doesn't have much voice in our life. And angels don't have much voice in our life. And the law doesn't have much voice in our life. And the old covenant doesn't have a lot of voice in our life. And so it can be a little difficult to make the connection. And yet it's going to say it again and again. Jesus is superior. And the driving force behind that is that when you understand that Jesus is superior, it motivates you to be faithful, to stay the course, to not give up. I am excited about what we're doing over the next couple of weeks. I am genuinely looking forward to the Seder meal where we will have an opportunity to experience Passover, which is the precursor to the coming of Jesus and the Lord's Supper. And we will be reminded in a very real way to look at Jesus, well, the one that was presented from Passover forward. I'm excited about Holy Week, Maundy, Thursday, around the table, where we will share the Lord's Supper as a community of friends. I'm not excited about Good Friday. As excited I am about the fact that I am redeemed, I hate Good Friday. Because I love Jesus and I hate the fact that he had to suffer and die. And yet it's such an important part of the experience of recognizing the darkness that sin created. But boy, I do love the Sunday following. Resurrection. Today, like every Sunday, I invite you to consider Jesus. That's really what this is about, right? Taking a look at Jesus. You hold in your hand a simple little chalice and platen. And on one side, you'll find a wafer. And as you hold that wafer, consider Jesus. Fix your eyes on the body of Jesus, who gave his life for you. And as you think of the wonder of Jesus, drink in his memory and in his honor. Now, let's actually go to the text, Hebrews chapter 3. where the very first thing he says is, consider Jesus. Take a look at Jesus. Listen and read. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in the heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses was also faithful in all God's house. For Jesus has been counted worthy of more honor or more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son, and we are his house, if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting in our hope. This text reminds us of who we are. Did you notice that, particularly in verse 1 and verse 6? We're holy, chosen. We've made a confession, and we're a part of this group of people that has made this confession that Jesus is the Christ. And he says in verse 6, we are the household of God himself. We have become his house. Because of whose we are, he says, you can have the power to be faithful. It's your identity that leads to this ability to have resilience and grit and be able to overcome the circumstances of your life. And in order to do that, he says what you need to do is consider Jesus. Now, if you go home this afternoon, well, it won't be afternoon, I promise it won't be that long. If you get in a conversation after church, whenever it lets out, and somebody says, what was the sermon about? Would you please answer this way? Consider Jesus. Take a look at Jesus, because when you see him and your identity in him, then you have the confidence to live. Now, what do I look at? That would be the question. If I'm going to consider Jesus, what do I consider? Well, the text is very clear. Look at verses 1 and 2. Look at the faithfulness of Jesus to his calling, to what God has sent him into the world to do. What Jesus does is model for us absolute faithfulness to God's purpose. Did you see it? Look at verses 1 and 2. God appointed him to be an apostle and high priest. As an apostle, he was sent from God to do the purposes of God. He became the incarnate person of God in our presence. That's God's purpose for him, and he faithfully carried that out. He gets us because he came and lived not just among us, he lived as one of us. He understands us. He gets us. He knows the pain. He knows the grief. He knows the discomfort. He knows the joy. He knows the excitement. He knows it because he lived it with us and for us. But he's also a high priest. He's the one who makes the atoning sacrifice. And in his case, he is, in fact, the sacrifice himself. So it's not just that he gets us. He also has us. He has redeemed us, and he is in a process of reshaping us into something entirely different than we have ever been before. I was so, I don't know why, caught off guard. Maybe that's not the right term, but early in our small group, in our Connect group, we made reference to one of my very favorite verses, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. He became sin for us that we might become the righteousness of God. And I just was struck again by the magnitude of that. He faithfully carried out his purpose. He would not give up. And so he says, take a look. And it's not just that we spend our time taking a look at Jesus. We take a look at the people of Jesus. I have friends who, as a young couple, went to the mission field and experienced what I would consider to be among the most horrendous things ever. They were attacked in their home. The husband was tied up in a chair and forced to watch while his wife was brutally raped. And they're still there. They're still serving those same people. They're still loving them in the name of Jesus. And I want to know, where do you get that kind of grit? You can answer that question. You take a look at Jesus. I think of a junior high track meet and a runner doing the hurdles. Second hurdle, flat on their face, and immediately back up, running. And about the fourth hurdle, back on the face, and then up and running. They did not finish first. They won. They won because they finished, because they weren't defeated. They had resilience and grit to keep going. That's what this is about, right? It's about finding the grit to just stay with it. Where does it come from? Look at Jesus and the people of Jesus and consider what they've done and learn from them to have that kind of resilience and grit that carries you through whatever life brings. So, if he can do it, we can do it. Consider him, it says, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. But that's not all you consider. Verses 3 and 4 tell you to take a look at Jesus and consider this. He is of greater worth. Consider his great worth. He is worthy of more glory than Moses. And you go, whoa! Now, you don't. I don't because, well, frankly, Moses is Moses. He's that Old Testament guy that led people out of Egypt. And, you know, and we know he did some really cool stuff, like he parted the Red Sea, and he went up on a mountain, and he received the law of God, and he hit a rock, and out came water, and he led people over to the edge of the Promised Land and delivered them to where God wanted them to go. He was an absolutely incredibly important person to Old Testament people. They got that. That's why it was such a stunning comment when they heard this text read to them that he is worthy of more glory than Moses, and you go, whoa. You know, some of you have that struggle. Yeah, not with Moses. Just when things stun you. Caitlin Clark has become the highest scoring collegiate basketball player in the history of collegiate basketball. And every day I see a post on there, she's not as good as Pete Maravich, because Pete Maravich was this and Pete Maravich was that. I wouldn't argue that with you. I would say apples and oranges. What I would say is what that betrays in us, what it reveals to us, is that when we have our head set on something, we're not easy to convince otherwise. So when the writer of Hebrews said, Jesus is worthy, he's superior, he's worth more glory than Moses, the natural reaction is, oh, whoa, wait. But think about it. Moses led them out of Egypt, out of their physical bondage. Jesus leads you out of your brokenness and your bondage to death and sin. I don't know if there's a comparison there. Moses gave them a law. Jesus came and fulfilled the law and showed us what the law really was supposed to produce. Moses gave them a tabernacle. Jesus became the presence of God when he tabernacled among us. Moses helped create a people of God. Jesus created the people of God. He's of greater worth. He has more glory. Just, he says, like the builder has more glory than the house. A few years ago, we had an opportunity to chase waterfalls. By the way, they're not hard to catch. You just have to find them and then walk to them. But we went on a waterfall chasing trip. And one of the waterfalls we saw was underneath a Frank Lloyd Wright house called Falling Water. It's absolutely incredible. And I stood there and I looked at how he integrated the terrain, the what the experts call the organic material around him, and turned it into this utterly incredible house. Now, I'm fascinated by the house, but I am really fascinated by the builder. For years, we've done the architectural tours and the builder's tours here in Quincy, and some of those houses are, whew, boy, they're really neat. But I also have a running list of architects and builders that if I ever wanted somebody to build my house, I know which one I want to do my building, because the builder is of greater worth than the house. You heard it in the text, right? He created it all. Isn't that interesting how you can do that? You can look at I call it a product. I don't know if that's the right word, but it doesn't just call attention to itself. It calls attention to the builder, the creator, the one behind it. That's what creation does, right? Creation is designed to make you go, wow, and then go, oh, God is really powerful. I had the privilege of having, I think, two, maybe three of six children in a family in classes that I taught at Lincoln. They came from down in southern Illinois. A family of six kids, every single one of them faithful to Jesus, lovers of God, servants in the church, not all in professional ministry, maybe none, I don't know, but all of them serving God and serving the church. And so one Sunday night, they came to the church that Gail and I attended, and we listened to them talk about their parents and how they were raised and the values and the qualities. And I remember sitting there thinking, those are magnificent kids. And man, they must have great parents. Because the product, forgive me children, you're not really a product, but is not as important as the parent, the house, the builder. And so he says, consider Jesus, who is so much more superior than Moses, just like the builder is more superior than the house. And he says, if you want to have this kind of grit, if you want to have the resilience to get through, don't turn your attention to the product. Turn your attention to the builder. Take a look at Jesus. He is the author and finisher of our faith. And if he says, as the creator of the universe, I am with you always, trust that. And it will stir in you resilience. You can do this because he is with you in the process. There's another thing he says in this text that you should look at when you look at Jesus. It's down here in verses 5 and 6, and that is that you should consider his role as the one who fulfills all of God's promises. Did you see that part in there where it says there were things that were spoken later? You know, we're looking forward. There's some promises yet to come. We're going to actually look at that pretty carefully in the next couple of chapters. I love Paul's statement to the Corinthians that Jesus is God's divine Yes. God made promises and Jesus came and fulfilled the promises. You know, that's exactly why what you see so often in Scripture sounds a lot like what happened in Acts chapter 2. This is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel. They look at the things that are happening and they look back and say, yeah, that Jesus is the fulfillment of that. He's the one who makes that all true. It's why Matthew could look back at such an innocent experience of Joseph and Mary taking Jesus down into Egypt and bringing him back to live in Israel and say, out of Egypt I called my son, and that fulfills that promise of God that he made. Jesus is the one who fulfills all of the promises of God. He's the one who keeps God's word, who makes everything come true. He is the one who does for us what God has promised that he's going to do for us. In fact, to be honest with you, when I read the promises and then I see what Jesus did, it reminds me of a friend of mine. Now, this is a long time ago, who promised his son a typewriter. Do any of you know what that is? Okay, all right. Promised his son a typewriter for graduation so he could write papers when he went to college. But by the time his son graduated from college, he ended up giving him a computer. Not only did he fulfill the promise, he far exceeded the promise. That's Jesus. God makes these magnificent promises, and Jesus comes along and not just fulfills them, but exceeds them in ways that are absolutely incredible. And so he says down here in verse number 6, Christ is faithful over God's house as a son. We are his house. If indeed we hold fast our confidence and our bold hope. You know, Jesus told a story during his life in which a widow went to a judge and wanted the judge to make a decision. And the judge didn't make a decision, didn't want to make a decision, refused to make a decision. And the woman went back and knocked on his door and kept knocking on his door. In fact, we call it the parable of the persistent widow. She just kept banging on his door, banging on his door, banging on his door, banging on his door, until he finally gave her an answer. And at the end of that parable, Jesus says, this is to teach us that we should just keep praying and not give up. But then he asks this really interesting question. He says, when the Son of Man returns to earth, will he find faith on earth? Wow. That's a pretty penetrating question. When he comes to your house, when he comes to my house, when he comes to my children's homes, will he find faith on earth? You notice in verse number 6, it asks it in such a way that it's placed as a condition. These things are true if you hold fast. The way that's written, the expected answer is built in to the condition. And the expected answer is, yes, he will. Yes, he will. The writer of Hebrews believed that these people were, in fact, going to hold fast. In spite of their circumstances, they would hold fast. Why? Because they would contemplate Jesus. Father, you know that what we need in our brokenness, what we need in our circumstances is just to take a look at Jesus, just to fix our eyes on Jesus, just to consider and contemplate Jesus. And so, Father, that's our commitment. We are going to say to you, I have decided to follow Jesus. I am committed to that. I will do that. And we will say it and we will sing it with the conviction of one who knows it'll be hard, who knows it'll be a challenge, who knows that nobody else will want us to do that except the ones who really love us. But we're going to say it. We're going to do it. We're going to resolve to follow Jesus because we know the only way that we get through this life is to turn our eyes on the superior one, Jesus himself.